Before I launch into my sermon, I want to do some thanking. The Racial Justice Task Force, diversity team that came before it, without the work that I've learned to do on myself in racial justice work, I wouldn't be standing here having anything to say to you today. So I want to thank everybody who's been part of my spiritual growth, and all of you as well. Of course, my wife and daughter, and all the ways you guys inspire me and support me, and worship committee, Carrie and Michael, who helped me to put all this together. The title of my sermon, Racism is the White Man's Burden, I hope to call our attention to the strength we have as a community, to use that strength to do the work that we need to do here in our church so that we can be a force in racial justice and all forms of justice in the world. When I first met Ken, I simply didn't like him. I thought he was an arrogant bigot. I remember a dinner party at his house and how he complained about black people at his workplace. He said they used race as an excuse for laziness. They didn't want to work. And you couldn't criticize their work without offending them. To be honest, I hated him. He made me sick, and I thought he was a typical white rich snob. What I didn't realize is what I was thinking of myself in that context. I didn't articulate it to myself at the time, but I certainly thought myself far superior to him. Morally, intellectually, and in all ways an all-around better person. Ironic to think myself superior in the context of my accusations about himself thinking himself superior. Here I am, some 10 years plus later, better able to see myself and my whiteness in the mirror. Last year, fellow congregant Charles Alexander gave us an inspiring and timely sermon entitled Church in the Mirror. My sermon today is an effort to continue the spiritual work that Charles so well named for us. To quote from Charles, "When we think of the words white supremacy, we think of disgruntled, angry white men draped in bedsheets, terrorizing people of color. But it is not Klan-style white supremacy that poses the greatest threat to Unitarian Universalism. It is the moderate voice of white supremacy that poses the greatest threat, the moderate voice of white supremacy that is most damaging." Unquote. What is this moderate white supremacy? Well, whiteness is a consciousness. It's a worldview, hierarchical, rank order, status-driven system. Materialistic, outcome-oriented, focused upon winning. It, by definition, creates race and divides the world into fractions and castes. It's a worldview that situates white people as superior at the top of the caste. Again, to quote from Charles's sermon, "Moderate white supremacy is systemic, invasive, and self-perpetuating, continually prioritizing white cultural values and interests above those of marginalized people of color. It permeates and corrupts our practices, systems, and institutions, even corrupting the reforms we institute to bring about equality." Unquote. What does whiteness, moderate white supremacy, do to white people? To be sure, it is one of many layers of consciousness and identity we embody. We are far more than white. We may identify with our European heritage, and we may value being American for the people we've known and loved and the communities we cherish. We share our common UU faith. We are caring, thoughtful, and invested in our spiritual growth. And we might actually be quite adept at managing difficult emotion and interpersonal conflict when we're grounded within the identities and sense of community that cultivate that which is authentic in us. It's in the context of race that we become white, that this white consciousness absorbs us. We become anxious, fragile, preparing ourselves for that anticipated blow to our self-esteem when we're made to feel guilty about racism. We become angry and self-righteous, ready to point the finger at the white racist so that the finger won't be pointed at us. When we're in that moderate white supremacy space, we compete for status and rank, to be the best white ally, the most emotionally demonstrative, the one who knows the most about Black history or has attended the most racial justice actions or trainings. I can speak from experience here. I see it in myself. Not just in those moments when I'm finding myself seeking the approval of Black activists, but when I'm interacting with other white people like him. I've come to think of racism as the white man's burden in this way. It is important to stand up for those that are vulnerable, but when we make the fight against racism too much about good white people saving Black people from bad white people, we are perpetuating the hierarchical structure of white culture. White people still above Black people, even if in an intended benevolent way, and fighting against an enemy in the form of the bad white people. We lose sight of the goal, which is to eradicate the damage racism has done to our essential interconnectedness. The massive harm that has taken place under the diluted spell of racism can only happen when there is failure to see each other's humanity, when we have lost our grip on our essential interconnectedness. Racism cannot be healed by exclusion. This dynamic is insidious, and it spreads as we see within liberal white communities the same divisions, the sort of divisions we witnessed in our church when the Racial Justice Task Force was formed. You might recall the debate that unfolded at our annual meeting a few years ago. Black Lives Matter on one side, All Lives Matter on another side. There were hurt feelings that day, and there was anger and disappointment. There was very little opportunity for dialogue, not much of a chance to ask, "What makes you feel that way?" or to express, "Here's how I'm feeling about what you're saying." Consider that the absence of such dialogue might well have been influenced by the shape and structure of our meetings. Often we set up microphones on two sides of the aisle where a line of congregants have to wait their turn to voice their opinion. Think about circles and the difference between circles and parallel lines. Geometrically speaking, parallel lines never meet. They define two sides that never come together. A circle encloses, holds a space, and there is no escaping the togetherness. Perhaps the way we shape and organize our meetings arises out of the layers of white culture so embedded in our understanding of reality, We can't see it or even think about it. I believe we saw a similar phenomenon when we lost our beloved ministers. We split into sides, parallel lines. In many ways, we lost sight of each other. This community that thought itself united in liberal values became partisan, aligning with one minister or the other, for the board or against the board. In a way, this liberal community split into a liberal and conservative factions, one side challenging authority, the other protecting authority. And remember the context, race, the loss of our Black minister. Many of us forgot that the same board members were also our fellow congregants. And many of us couldn't consider how we might be repeating something rising out of the shadows of the trauma of racism through the structures and roles embedded within the body and governance of our church. As we've struggled through these challenges in our community, I've also seen many circles form. The healing circles where congregants met not to protest or investigate what happened when we lost our ministers, but to be together to recognize the loss. We formed a healing task force. I think to the extent that the healing task force was helpful, it was because we worked on healing ourselves first. We told each other our personal stories of loss. What we had in common was the deep, everlasting movement of our hearts and spirits. For some of us, our spirits were touched most authentically by Reverend Leon, for some by Reverend Liz, and still others in different ways by both ministers. We recognized what was most important in the revelation of our personal stories, not which minister was better or who more wrong and blameworthy, but the honoring of the diverse ways each of our hearts were touched and our spirits were given ministry. I think the greatest success of the healing task force might have been what we did for each other. I think we became a healing circle. I believe through this experience of losing our ministers, we're learning about our way of counting upon a beloved leader to make everything better. And we've heard this before from many others. We're learning how to be a collective, to rely upon our interconnectedness with each other. It's one of our UU principles that comes out of the essential worth and dignity of every human being. It's our belief in our essential interconnectedness, and as Charles called it, our collective consciousness. And as he pointed out in his sermon, we are the church. I wonder about the impact of white culture upon our capacity to trust this space of interconnectedness. Might the self-contained individualism of white culture at times blind us to the collective? Perhaps more ominous, might the idea of white community be all too closely linked in the minds of white liberals to white supremacy in the form of white nationalism? I'm going to quote here from my own work, an article entitled Reflections on the Trauma of Racism. Racism is trauma. It leaves vague and disturbing impressions within our minds and bodies. It's more than the implicit bias implied when a white woman clutches her purse in the presence of Black teenagers. It's the history of slavery, segregation, lynching, ghettos, mass incarceration, and police violence. Not just the historical and present-day facts, but the lived experience of human cruelty. And to really enter the space of this trauma, that is both historical and ongoing feels dangerous. It's painful, it's brutal. It's riddled with shame and despair. Really, to talk about racism is to face inhumanity. It is to see the flesh and bone of cruelty, suffering, and unbearable grief. It's this unprocessed layer of the trauma of racism that's like an abyss. Consider the fragility and rage white people experience in the context of talking about racism. I recall Reverend Leon saying at a diversity team meeting, "The spiritual crime is unspeakable. We can't even fathom it." In my professional life as a psychotherapist, I work with the unspeakable traumas of childhood abuse, and I'm learning to work with the trauma of racism. One thing I've learned is that it's impossible to work effectively with trauma, to be in a healing process single-handedly. I carry my professional community with me into my work, and I've come to carry you, my spiritual community. I'm learning to let go of my self-centered desires to be the adored hero, and to let myself be fed in circles of our spiritual spaces. I've learned to recognize that my white privilege is the same white privilege that Ken has. In fact, before casting aspersions upon the white working class or rural folks that voted for Trump, I'm remembering that my white privilege is far more substantial than for many poor white people. I've been inspired by stories of people like Derek Black. There's an article published in the Jewish journal, The Sun Sentinel, that tells the story of the conversion of Derek Black, a former white nationalist. And to quote from the article, "When Derek enrolled in New College of Florida, a top-ranked liberal arts school in Sarasota, he kept his extremist views and his KKK affiliation to himself, even while continuing to host a supremacist radio show. One night in 2011, a fellow student was Googling hate groups when he came across Derek's picture. By the next semester, nobody would talk to Derek or even come near him, and he avoided public places or events for fear of hostility. One of Derek's acquaintances started reading Stormfront and listening to Derek's radio show to get insight into Derek's thinking. Then he did something radical, unexpected and uncomfortable. He texted Derek, 'What are you doing Friday night?' The classmate was Matthew Stevenson, the only Orthodox Jew at the school. Matthew hosted weekly Shabbat dinners in his campus apartment and decided to invite Derek, figuring if Derek was going to hate Jews, he might as well meet one and know more about them. Matthew Stevenson heroically befriended Derek and gave him a space within his social circle. And over time, the strength of the friendship and learning that challenged Derek's belief systems catalyzed a radical change. Derek took classes in Judaism, he denounced white supremacy and his white nationalist affiliations. This was a painful transition for Derek. For a long time, his parents wouldn't speak to him. Derek had a close relationship with his father, who is also a white nationalist. In many ways, and I read about his relationship with his father, and in many ways, their relationship was like any other father-son relationship. If Matthew and Derek can enter this trauma space and come out transformed, think of the spiritual work we can do within our community. Again, a quote from my article, Reflections on the Trauma of Racism. There's a wider perspective where there's great relief and joy to be found in shattering the illusions of racism. To enter the abyss and survive is to discover ways of shared knowing of the trauma. It is to see and feel life pulsating within each other. It is to join in that wellspring of creativity, love, and freedom that is there beyond the illusions. Over the years, things changed between Ken and I. There was no defining moment, no single conversation in which we hashed out our viewpoints about race. It was like a slow melting away of tensions as I got to know Ken. I think because I knew he was an important person in my social circle, because there were people I loved that loved him, I determined I'd better figure out how to get along with him. I started to know how much Ken loved his children. I could see his anxiety when his eldest chose a career in the arts. How would he make a living? And I kept listening to Ken, witnessing the anxiety on his face when he talked about money, and I realized how frightened he was of falling into poverty. He had family members that had serious financial troubles. It worried Ken to no end. He wanted so much to impress upon them the importance of financial responsibility and the idea that in this world you have to look out for yourself. Now that I could see Ken as part of the human family just like me, and imagine my arrogance to think otherwise, we started spending more time together. He started to take an interest in the racial justice work I was doing. He accompanied me to Carter Barron for a music event of African-American local musicians. We've talked about a professional conference I recently organized that addresses the problems of white supremacy and racism within the mental health field. He listened with respect, respect that I didn't give him some 10 plus years ago. Still, I can see his anxious concern about money, making sure you put yourself first. He says to me, so this conference, it will help you advance your career, right? I mean, it'll get your name out there. Before I respond, I have to remind myself that I indeed had my moments imagining an adoring reception from the audience in the run-up to my conference. I told him, you know, it might help my career in that way, but the thing that matters most to me is that I'm doing something I love. That's a blessing, isn't it? When your work is the thing you love. I found that racism feels like a burden to me when I'm most absorbed in this moderate white supremacy consciousness. When I manage to operate from within my spiritual center, from within our essential interconnectedness, racial justice work and all justice work becomes a responsibility I embrace with joy and humility. Look in the mirror, and in fact, you might find we are each other's mirror. To know myself authentically, I need all of you. We need each other. Before I step down, I want to just mention a couple of important things going on in the Racial Justice Task Force. This past Wednesday, we had a very inspired training that Daniel Clark put together. David Compt did a White Ally training here. It was really well attended and a powerful experience. And be on the lookout for study circles coming up, which Charles is bringing here, that I think is really going to help us continue to move forward in this work. Thank you.